So I'm going to first review the steps involved in the construction of an EFT. Then I'll review a couple examples of EFTs in condensed matter physics, EFTs for superfluid helium-3, and EFTs for quantum Hall liquids. And then I'll try to extract from these examples characteristics that that characterize the relation between an EFT and a high-energy theory. And these characteristics are then going to suggest an appropriate notion of emergence for EFTs. And then I'll compare this notion with other notions of emergence that have appeared in the philosophical literature. So to begin, I'd like to briefly review the steps involved in the construction of an EFT. So given a high-energy theory encoded in a Lagrangian density, the first step, we're told, is to identify and eliminate the high-energy degrees of freedom. And this involves first choosing a cutoff and then decomposing the degrees of freedom of the high-energy theory into high-energy and low-energy parts. And then we perform the integration over the high-energy degrees of freedom in the corresponding generating functional. Right? And the result is supposed to be an effective Lagrangian density that depends only on the low-energy degrees of freedom. Now, I take it in practice, this path integral is, doesn't have an exact solution in most cases. And even when it does, the result in effective Lagrangian density may contain non-local terms. And so this motivates the second step, which is to construct a local operator expansion of the effective Lagrangian density, where the point of expansion can be taken to be the free Lagrangian density, and the sum is supposed to be all is supposed to be over all local operators consistent with the symmetries of the high-energy theory. Now, these steps can be characterized by the following. See that the high-energy Lagrangian density typically has an infinite number of degrees of freedom, whereas the effective Lagrangian density has a finite number. Second, the effective Lagrangian density is typically formally distinct from the high-energy Lagrangian density. And to the extent that this entails the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion are distinct, this suggests that the low-energy degrees of freedom described by the effective theory are dynamically distinct from the degrees of freedom of the high-energy theory. And finally, arguably, the relation between an effective theory and a high-energy theory cannot be presented as a formal derivation. Right? So in the first step, in the construction of an EFT, there's an informal choice of cutoff and also an informal identification of the low-energy degrees of freedom. Right? For any given high-energy theory, more than one choice of cutoff and subsequently more than one choice of low-energy degrees of freedom can be made. And secondly, in the second step, this involves an approximation procedure involving, again, an informal identification of the symmetries of the high-energy theory. So this seems to suggest that the relation between an effective theory and a high-energy theory cannot be characterized as a formal relation. I don't think, not for the purposes of my talk. I don't think so.
Sorry, before you're excluding derivations that have been done, for example, axiomatic field theory. In the framework of axiomatic field theory.
Well, I guess my main concern is with sort of the standard Lagrangian formalism that appears in, that most, I guess, practicing physicists use as opposed to axiomatic methods. Okay, so maybe I should qualify that by typically cannot be characterized by a formal derivation. Sorry? Just that it can't be presented as a formal derivation. Right, that one sense of where this fails is, again, the sort of underdetermination of the high-energy theory by an effective theory. More than one effective theory can be constructed for a given high-energy theory. So, arguably, typically, the relation between an effective theory and a high-energy theory can't be presented as a formal relation, but it can be informally characterized through concrete examples. So let me look at a couple. The first involves effective theories for superfluid helium 3A. And in these examples, with respect to a critical temperature, high energy degrees of freedom can be identified with fermionic helium 3 atoms arranged in Cooper pairs and described by a non-relativistic Lagrangian density. Here I'm following a review article by Schockel. So here the field variable encodes creation annihilation operators for helium 3 atoms, and the order parameter in the interaction piece encodes the particular Cooper pair interactions characterized in the A phase of superfluid helium 3. Now, with respect to this critical temperature, low energy degrees of freedom can be identified with bosonic hydrodynamical sound waves, described again by a non-relativistic Lagrangian density. But here the degrees of freedom encoded in the field variable encode the phase of the order parameter. And I guess the coefficients in front of these terms encode the fermion number density and the density of states. Now, with respect to the ground state, another set of low energy degrees of freedom can be identified as massless fermions coupled to a Maxwell field and described by a relativistic Lagrangian density, at least according to analysis given by Volovic. Now here, read literally, the field variable represents a relativistic Dirac force spinner, but from the point of view of the high energy theory, it still encodes creation annihilation operators for helium 3 atoms. And the gamma matrices are determined by a Lorentz signature metric that, from the point of view of the high energy theory, encodes the degrees of freedom of helium 3A Cooper pairs. And according to Volovic's analysis, the potential field that appears in this effective Lagrangian density, from the point of view of the high energy theory, encodes the position of the Fermi points in four momentum space. Where I take it, the Fermi points are the points where the energy spectrum vanishes. So to compare these three Lagrangian densities, right, the high energy theory encoded in one is formally and dynamically distinct from the low energy effective theories encoded in two and three. Right, the high energy theory is a non-relativistic quantum field theory describing fermionic degrees of freedom. The effective theory associated with the critical temperature is a non-relativistic quantum field theory describing bosonic degrees of freedom. And the effective theory of the ground state is a relativistic quantum field theory. Secondly, arguably these three theories describe distinct physical systems, at least if interpreted literally. The high energy theory describes non-relativistic fermionic helium 3 atoms. The effective theory associated with the critical temperature describes non-relativistic bosonic sound waves. And the effective theory of the ground state describes relativistic fermions coupled to a Maxwell field. So this example suggests that the relation between these effective theories and the high energy theory can be characterized in the following ways. First, it suggests that there's a failure of law-like deducibility in the sense that the laws of the effective theory are not deducible consequences of the laws of the high energy theory, at least if by laws we mean perhaps in part what's encoded in the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion associated with the corresponding Lagrangian densities. And secondly, these examples suggest that the relation between an EFT and a high energy theory can be characterized in terms of ontological distinctness, in the sense that the degrees of freedom of the effective theory are typically associated with physical systems that are distinct from the physical systems associated with the degrees of freedom of the high energy theory, at least if we read these theories literally. And while there's ontological distinctness, arguably there's still a sense of ontological dependence insofar as the degrees of freedom of the effective theory are exactly the low energy degrees of freedom of the high energy theory. Right? So there's a sense in which the physical systems described by an effective theory do not float free of those described by its high energy theory. Right? So the effective theory associated with the ground state of superfluid helium 3A, Volovic's theory that describes not relativistic fermions coupled to a Maxwell field, you can interpret that theory as describing low energy excitations, low energy ripples in the condensate, which is fundamentally constituted ultimately of helium-3 atoms. It's just that the low-energy ripples take the form, take the appearance and behavior of relativistic fermions coupled to a Maxwell field. Now, a second example might further help to reinforce these suggestions. And this example is of EFTs for two-dimensional quantum Hall liquids. In these examples, the high-energy degrees of freedom can be identified with electrons moving in a two-dimensional conductor and coupled to an external magnetic field and a Chern-Simons field, and characterized by a non-relativistic Lagrangian density. Here, the coefficient in front of the last Chern-Simons term is chosen so that the electrons encoded in the field variable have an even number of magnetic fluxes attached to them. So they're referred to as composite fermions or composite electrons. So technically, this description entails that when in the presence of a strong external magnetic field, the electrons experience the quantum Hall effect, right, which occurs when the conductivity of the system becomes quantized in units of E squared over H, where the constant nu is the ratio of number of electrons to number of states per energy level, what's referred to as the Fillon factor. So the integer quantum Hall effect occurs for integer values of nu, and the fractional quantum Hall effect occurs for values of nu that take the form of simple fractions. So these two effects are characterized by the system becoming incompressible, and also, I take it, the system also takes on characteristics of a superconductor. And this suggests that it's a distinct state of matter, referred to as a quantum Hall liquid. So the integer quantum Hall effect can be explained in terms of the discrete spacing between the energy levels. Right? For integer values of nu, the first nu energy levels are filled, so it takes a large cost of energy to further excite electrons to higher energy levels, and that's a characteristic of incompressibility. And in this picture, the fractional quantum Hall effect can be explained by noting that if you attach an even number of magnetic fluxes to the electrons, it cancels enough of the external magnetic field to reduce the Fillon factor back to an integer value. So the fractional quantum Hall effect in this characterization is just the integer quantum Hall effect for composite electrons. Now, the properties of a quantum Hall liquid can be derived from the high-energy theory by integrating out the electron degrees of freedom. And the result is an effective theory in which the degrees of freedom can be identified with two Chern-Simons fields and described by an effective Lagrangian density in which a space-time metric does not explicitly appear. So this is an example of a topological quantum field theory. So the degrees of freedom here are encoded in two Chern-Simons fields, and the coefficient in front of the second Chern-Simons term is chosen to produce the integer quantum Hall effect. Big A is the external magnetic field, and it's not. Oh yeah, I take it the two Chern-Simons fields are the little a and the big A plus the little a. No. Okay, yeah. Roughing over the details. I take it this is an effective theory of the fractional quantum Hall effect, but at least in one sense, it's not a low-energy effective theory. Incompressibility indicates the presence of an energy gap, so low-energy excitations cannot exist for the bulk liquid, but it turns out low-energy excitations can exist for the edge of the liquid, and a low-energy effective theory can be constructed for the edge, in which the degrees of freedom can be identified with bosonic hydrodynamical sound waves, characterized by an effective Lagrangian, a relativistic 1 plus 1 dimensional Lagrangian density, after the analysis of Wynne. So again, to compare these three theories, The high energy theory 4 is formally and dynamically distinct from the effective theories 5 and 6, again. The high energy theory is a non-relativistic QFT. The effective theory, the bulk liquid, is a topological QFT. And the low energy effective theory of the edge is a relativistic QFT. And secondly, again, at least if read literally, these three theories describe distinct physical systems. The high energy theory describes non-relativistic composite electrons. The effective theory of the bulk describes topological Chern-Simons fields. And the effective theory of the edge describes relativistic massless bosons. and again, this example suggests that the relation between the effective theories and the high energy theory can be characterized in terms of the failure of law-like deducibility and ontological distinctness, perhaps tempered by ontological dependence. So I'd now like to consider a notion of emergence that's appropriate for these examples and perhaps others like them. So to begin, let me note that in the philosophical literature, there are two general notions of emergence. One view views emergence as descriptive of the ontology, the entities or properties associated with the physical system with respect to another. So to say phenomena associated with an EFT are emergent in this ontological sense is to say the entities or properties described by the EFT emerge from those described by high energy theory. But a second sense of emergence views it as a formal relation between theories. So to say phenomena associated with an EFT are emergent in the second formal sense is to say the EFT stands in a certain formal relation to a high energy theory. Now, given that I've suggested that the relation between an EFT and a high energy theory cannot be characterized as a formal relation, the approach I'm going to take is to use the informal relation between an EFT and its high energy theory to inform an ontological notion of emergence appropriate for EFTs. So under this view, emergence is not a formal characteristic of theories, but rather an interpretation-dependent characteristic. Right? So whether or not properties or entities described by an EFT can be said to emerge from a high-energy theory is going to depend, at least under this view, on how the EFT is interpreted as well as how the high-energy theory is interpreted. So with that said, the examples I've discussed so far suggest the following desiderata for a notion of emergence appropriate for EFTs. First, such a notion should involve microphysicalism in the sense that the emergent system should ultimately be composed of microphysical systems that comprise the fundamental system and that obey the fundamental system's laws. And second, a notion of emergence appropriate for EFT should involve novelty in the sense that the properties of the emergent system should not be deducible from the properties of the fundamental system. In this case, it's not deducible you couldn't derive them from the properties of the fundamental theory. So probably that should be qualified with just those properties that one wishes to describe as emergent should have that characteristic.
So emergent is an adjective that modifies properties.
Under this ontological view. Right. But under a formal view, you might try to incorporate this law version of emergence. Now, both of these desiderata are underwritten in the EFT context, I'd like to suggest, by the elimination of degrees of freedom in the construction of an EFT. Right. So one might tell the following story about how the properties of a system described by an effective theory emerge from a fundamental system described by a high-energy theory. First, the high-energy degrees of freedom are integrated out of the high-energy theory, which entails that the degrees of freedom of the effective theory are exactly the low-energy degrees of freedom of the high-energy theory, and thus is microphysicalism secured. Second, the effect of Lagrangian density is expanded in a local operator expansion, the result is dynamically distinct from the high energy of Lagrangian density in the sense of a failure of law-like deducibility from the high energy theory of the properties described by the effective theory. And this is supposed to secure the notion of novelty. So again, I suggest that a concept of emergence appropriate for EFTs should be characterized by microphysicalism and novelty, underwritten by the elimination of degrees of freedom. Now, this notion of emergence is similar to one described by Paul Mainwood. He claims that microphysicalism and novelty characterize what he calls the new emergentism of condensed matter physicists like Anderson and Laughlin and Pines. In fact, the notions of microphysicalism and novelty I've essentially stolen from his analysis. However, Mainwood claims that the mechanisms that underwrite this, what he calls new emergentism, are spontaneous symmetry breaking and universality. And the only thing I'd point out here is that these mechanisms are typically not present in EFTs, at least generally understood. They are present in the example of EFTs for superfluid helium 3A. Right, the effective theory associated with the critical temperature is associated with the phase transition and the spontaneously broken symmetry. And Volovic's effective theory of the ground state characterizes a universality class defined by its Fermi point topology. But these mechanisms are not present in the example of EFTs for quantum Hall liquids. The effective theory of the bulk liquid, I guess there's a sense in which it's associated with the phase transition, but certainly that phase transition is not characterized by a spontaneously broken symmetry. It's a topological phase transition. And neither that effective theory or the effective theory of the edge characterizes a universality class. So the point is, not all cases in which degrees of freedom are eliminated in the construction of an EFT should be identified with spontaneous symmetry breaking and universality. Now, another approach to a concept of emergence in the philosophical literature that stresses the elimination of degrees of freedom is given in an article by Jessica Wilson on what she calls weak ontological emergence. So her claim is that elimination of degrees of freedom in a theory in physics plays two roles. First, according to Wilson, it secures the law-like deducibility of an emergent entity's behavior from its composing parts. And she takes this to underwrite a notion of physicalism, the presence of law-like deducibility. And second, elimination of degrees of freedom entails, according to Wilson, that an emergent entity is characterized by different law-governed properties and behavior than those of its composing parts. And she takes this to underwrite a notion of non-reductionism. Now, given that the elimination of degrees of freedom plays an essential role in the construction of EFTs, we might ask, is this analysis applicable to EFTs? And I would suggest that it is not, at least as insofar to the extent that that my characterization is accurate. Elimination of degrees of freedom in an EFT, I suggested, is characterized not the presence of law-like deducibility, but by its failure. And this is supposed to underwrite the notion of novelty. And second, I've suggested that elimination of degrees of freedom in an EFT is characterized by the retention in the EFT of the low-energy degrees of freedom of the high-energy theory. And this, under my analysis, this is what's supposed to underwrite microphysicalism, right? Not the presence of law-like deducibility. So while Wilson's concept of emergence may be applicable to some theories in physics, I'd like to suggest that it's not completely applicable to the EFT context. Now, a concept of emergence that strikes closer to the EFT context has been suggested by Bob Batterman. His concept is based on the failure of a limiting relation. Bob says there are two necessary conditions for the existence of an emergent property described by a theory T prime with respect to a more fundamental theory T. And these are that first there must be a limiting relation between T and T prime, and second, that the limiting relation must fail in the context in which the emergent property is identified. And in particular, there must be a physical singularity associated with the emergent property. So his example of emergent properties in this sense consists of properties associated with, one of his examples consists of properties associated with phase transitions involving spontaneously broken symmetries. Right, so here the fundamental theory is statistical mechanics, and the theory associated with the emergent properties is thermodynamics, and the limiting relation is the thermodynamic limit, where the degrees of freedom and the volume of the system are taken to infinity, while the density is held constant. So the limiting relation fails at a critical point. The corresponding physical singularity is a divergence in the correlation length, and the associated emergent properties, in this sense of emergence, are properties associated with the phase transition. Now, this example suggests a second example in which the emergent properties might be associated with a cutoff regulated theory. So in this example, the fundamental theory is a renormalizable continuum theory. The theory associated with the emergent properties is a cutoff regulated theory that you obtain from the continuum theory by inserting a cutoff, right, perhaps to regularize ultraviolet divergences. And the limiting relation is the renormalization procedure where you take the cutoff and the bare parameters of the continuum theory to infinity while holding the renormalized parameters constant. So again, here the limiting relation fails at a fixed point. The corresponding physical singularity is a divergence in a Green's function, perhaps. And the associated emergent properties are would be those properties associated with the system at a fixed point. So the second example suggests a possible analogy with the EFT case. Right? Perhaps we can identify the fundamental theory with the high energy theory and the theory associated with emergent properties with an EFT. But I'd like to suggest that this analogy is not complete. Simply put, not all EFTs can be obtained from renormalizable high energy theories. Again, in this case, a limiting relation cannot be constructed in general between an EFT and a high energy theory. And one way to see this is to note that in example two, the fundamental theory and the theory associated with emergent properties are formally identical. Whereas this is not always the case in the context of an EFT. An EFT and a high energy theory are not necessarily formally identical. I'd like to suggest that a concept of emergence based on the concepts of microphysicalism and novelty underwritten by the elimination degrees of freedom perhaps is a better characteristic, is a more appropriate notion for emergence in the context of EFTs than perhaps a notion based on the failure of a limiting relation. So to conclude then, I've suggested that emergence in an EFT can be characterized by the elimination of degrees of freedom from a high energy theory. This results in an EFT that can be interpreted as describing novel entities or properties in the sense of being dynamically independent of and thus not deducible from the entities or properties associated with a high energy theory. And these novel properties or entities can be said to ultimately be composed of the entities or properties that are constitutive of a high energy theory insofar as the degrees of freedom exhibited by the effective theory are exactly the low energy degrees of freedom exhibited by the high energy theory.
I think I'm missing some subtlety here. When you talk about the failure of law-like deducibility, if you look at different effective Lagrangians coming from the same high-energy theory, they're different because there are different assumptions that go into the reduction from one theory to the other, whether it's the choice of cutoff or details like that. But certainly one's not deducible from the other if you wash away all memory of what those assumptions were, but as long as you retain memory of what those things were, then they come from the larger theory in a definite way. So I'm not understanding the distinction or where that failure of deducibility is, as long as you keep track of how you got there.
Yeah, I guess one way to respond to that question is to consider different notions of deducibility. What counts as an example of one theory being deducible from another theory? my intuition is, at least at some level, it doesn't seem to me that a deductive relation exists between a high-energy theory and an EFT, at least an EFT constructed by means of these two steps. Right? I mean, insofar as there is this underdetermination of a high-energy theory by any given effective field theory that you've constructed for it. Right? In other words, you can't. Given an effective field theory, you can't go from it back to the high energy theory, at least at some level.
Sorry, we have a queue of people already. Sorry. Okay. It's a very good discussion on the effective field theory using these two very well known examples. I just want to make a quick comment that actually many of these things in effective field theory are quite subsumed issues, in particular in quantum open system or open system, in fact, in general. Now, in there, what you said, integrating out, is referred to as coarse graining. And my question here is, in these intermediate structures or level of substructure which you illustrated with your level 1, 2, 3 theories, for example. Oftentimes, it's because we know the variables that are of physical interest that we integrate out other things, right? And in fact, in open system, if you have two procedures and they are totally non-commutative, right? For example, if you have these three set of variables, what you're interested in the open system comes from the back reaction of your environment. And there is actually a nested set of environments if you look at different level, energy levels or scales involved, right? So again, the emergence of a theory, intermediate, whatever, really depends on some knowledge of what you are targeting. Now, but then emergence, as we are trying to understand, right, is how does that come about, even with this knowledge? You know, if you start with micro theory, and many condensed metaphysicists gave me the example that the quantum Hall effect is something that you cannot derive simply from microphysics unless you're told by the experimentalists there's such a phenomena manifesting at the macroscopic level. Could you, shed light on that key point, please?
So is the idea that if you're given additional information, then you can deduce an effective theory from a high energy theory. But in
Let's forget about my next point. The key there is how do you know the immediate structure and your
So again, that seems to suggest support the idea that there is no law-like deducibility between an effective theory and a high-energy theory. But that might, you know, it might call into question. I mean, if you know sort of the intermediate structures, then that might call into question whether or not an effective theory can be associated with the sense of novelty, I guess. I mean.
So I have a question that can be aimed at both of them, and but I'm struck by how uncritical you guys seem to be about the existence and the notion of the fundamental theory and your formulation of microphysicalism or the analogous thing, because the things that you talked about as fundamental theories, I would recognize as a particle physicist as emergent from the standard model of particle physics, but most particle physicists these days regard the standard model of particle physics itself, hypothetically, as an emergent effective field theory which characterizes some emergent degrees of freedom for some unknown fundamental theory. And I wonder what advice you can give us with this kind of analysis. I mean, what kind of, is there any, absent a particular experimental confirmation of a hypothesis about a fundamental theory, Is there actually any content to the claim that the standard model is an effective theory, while the fundamental theory that we hypothesize exists remains completely unknown without any experimental characterization of what its degrees of freedom or fundamental law might be?
I guess one thing I could say is that this characterization of emergence, I mean, I guess is based on the top-down approach to the construction of an EFT. Right? It's the context in which the high-energy theory is known, and we're trying to construct an effective theory. But there's a bottom-up approach, too, where the high-energy theory is not known.
Let me try to put my question more sharply. Would it be acceptable for somebody to assert, is there any philosophical objection to somebody asserting simply that our knowledge of fundamental physics is always based on an effective field theory because our experimentally investigated domain always has a cutoff on it, both an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, and therefore the notion of a fundamental theory is playing no role in fundamental physics, and I do know people who would assert this, and is to be replaced by a notion that all knowledge of fundamental physics is in the context of effective field theory.
Could I interject this chart? Sorry, it seems like your notion, you could say, is relative to something which you take as fundamental, but doesn't have to be fundamental in the sense, you know, you could still see it as a further effective field theory, but relative to that theory, you could have a notion of emergent phenomena, right, which you're characterizing. So you don't actually have to take a stand on whether the theory that you're integrating out to get the effective field theory is itself a final theory in order for your analysis of emergence in terms of microphysicalism and novelty to go through. Is that right?
Could the notion of effective field theory really stand for as the description of our knowledge of fundamental physics without any need to posit, quote, a most fundamental theory? Yes, delimited by with the infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, delimited by the actual experimental bounds.
Yeah, I was just gonna get in on that because that was something I was trying to be specific about, that I was not considering that kind of case, right, where you have a fundamental theory. Well, so there's, I guess, two questions. One is, could you consider your the standard model to be an effective field theory in the sense that it's an effective low energy theory, and we don't know what the degrees of freedom are going to be of the of the fundamental theory. And then the second question is, why need to assume there's any sort of fundamental theory at all, right, at the end of the day? In response to the first question, maybe that's where I push on the idea that there's a difference between the sorts of things you want to explain and what sort of perspective you take as a particle physicist and what you're doing when you're doing considering effective field theories in statistical mechanics. In both cases, there's, I presume, correct me if I'm wrong, ignorance about what the higher energy microphysical Hamiltonians are. But in the particle physics case, you're gonna push that further and then ask the sort of supplementary question about whether you're even going to assume that at some high energy scale you're gonna have a quantum field theory at all, right? Whether you're gonna have a Hamiltonian Lagrangian description of what's going on, whether you're gonna have something completely different, right? Some completely different degrees of freedom. So maybe I push on that as a difference between ignorance in the two domains.
Yeah, but I wonder if, I mean, if you take that view of a sort of a tower of EFTs, whether a notion of emergence is going to be applicable or whether it sort of trivializes a notion of emergence. I mean, if we consider the standard model to be an EFT, then there's a sense in which all entities and properties associated with it.
Mm-hmm. So, Philip, you had a question earlier, or
go. That's the
microphone. I just wanted to raise a little point of detail, which may or may not be important. It may play the role of a butterfly or a microcrack, or it may just be totally uninteresting. You made the really clear point that these theories at the different levels of description were different from each other. But then, to my surprise, you then said, well, but the low energy degrees of freedom of the big L, as it were, are the same as the ones of the L effective. But actually, that's not true. I mean, it's absolutely not the same. So if, for example, we take your first case, the superfluid, then if I look at the Hamiltonian, which is also an effective Hamiltonian, of course, as Lee points out, they're all effective Hamiltonians, it does not contain a gap. There's no gap in the excitation spectrum. And so the prediction from that effective Hamiltonian would be, for example, that the specific heat was linear at low temperatures. Whereas if you now go to your next theory, it has a gap. And so the specific heat is utterly different. So these theories do not contain the same low energy excitations. The problem here is that there's this inevitable tendency to slide between the model, which is a formal model, and the physics. And so you say, well, but we know that they're the same physical system. Therefore, they ought to have the same low energy degrees of freedom. Well, we believe that's the case. There's only one world, apparently. But the models are not the same, and they don't have the same low energy degrees of freedom. And one of the problems with another technical point, which I think might blow up in your face, is that these effective Hamiltonians have been writing down throw out a lot of important terms, mainly because the people writing these papers don't want to think about them, not because they're not important. So, for example, yeah, but you wrote a review article which had many more than four pages, and you also threw out the terms. So, for example, in the case of the helium-3, the Fermi liquid corrections, as they're often called, are not put in. And the argument is, oh, well, these are irrelevant. Problem is that they're not. If they pass certain known limits, for example, the limits delineated by Pomeranchuk, they'll change the low temperature phases. At this point, one can say, well, okay, but how many other terms have been left out? So I think that these minor technical points are actually important because they completely undermine, in fact, the sort of article of faith that there is eventually going to be a theory. I mean, I guess I agree completely with Lee. We've got no particular reason to believe that. I wouldn't characterize it as a tower because it doesn't necessarily have a base. Yeah.
I think I'm worrying about issues of language, but the language is something that bothers me. One of the pieces of language that is bothering me is a question of law-like. If you eliminate degrees of freedom, as one does in the renormalization semi-group, I insist on the word semi for the renormalization group, because that's, in essence, the major piece of the argument. If you could eliminate degrees of freedom by a logical and correct argument, do you not then have a law-like relation between the low-energy theory and the high-energy theorem? I would claim that in the ordinary use of language, the relation is law-like. That you are welcome to use language that you want to define your terms carefully. You have defined your terms carefully, so you're welcome to use it, but initially it confused me. The second piece is, I guess, the same as Philip's discussion, or almost the same. You describe the different levels of description as having different physical entities related to them. It's the same pot of helium. It's the same thing. It's just described as in different ways. And the reason that one has different degrees of freedom is partially the reason emphasized by Bob Batterman, and that is using the renormalization semi-group or elimination of degrees of freedom or similar arguments. One is, in fact, doing a limiting process, which then must be taken into account in understanding what one is doing. And a limiting process can give you things that are not exactly contained in an obvious way in the thing that you're limiting.
I think my question is, my comment does not require an answer because I did not object to a single thing in what was being said. I just said that I would use different words for it.
Right.
Okay.
This is a question related to the first two speakers. I was not aware of Nancy Cartwright's criticism about models, range of applicability. Because as physicists, we live happily with models and look at universal quantities and so on. Then came the second lecture, where models like continuum models were questioned in real context. So I just want to know what was Nancy Cartwright's criticism about models in science. I'm not aware of that. And was she right in the sense, how right she was?
I'm speaking out of school in that she is a philosopher and I'm a physicist. However, I have read her, and maybe that qualifies me to speak about her, or maybe not. What she seems to be saying, first of all, she's attempting, in my view, to be provocative to physicists and other people who hold views like my own. But she's basically saying that very small portion of the physical universe is describable in terms of the models we usually use. That is, basically, she says, for example, that quantum electrodynamics applies to nothing much except a series of specialized experiments that take place at specialized facilities. Whereas I would, in contrast, argue that quantum electrodynamics applies to almost everything everywhere. You may take either point of view, because in fact, they're both correct in some sense. I am then contrasting her point of view with a limited and narrow applicability of models with what appears to be true for the Kolmogorov model of the circle model, which I was then arguing applied to almost all synchronization phenomena. I was then trying to rhetorically make a point about what we could do with models, especially since I believe philosophers are interested in the question of what we can do with models.
Thank you.
Just a question, I mean, whether you really need to Jonathan, to insist that the degree of freedom are exactly the low energy or are constructed from. I think it seems to me that you, at least the line of thought that you're trying to put forward could still hold if you weaken. Because you don't need, I mean, actually, it seems to me, to insist that they are the same, but that they are constructed somehow and correspond in some interesting way to the... I don't know if it works, I mean, but...
Yeah, I mean, I was just motivated by the purely formal aspect of the first step, where you're told to integrate out the high energy degrees of freedom, and explicitly the things that remain are the low energy degrees of freedom. But, I mean... whether you're, you know, to get the full EFT requires other sort of messy details. I haven't considered. But yeah, I mean, that was my motivation, sort of the purely formal aspect of the way EFTs are constructed. But yeah, I'm given that the notion of emergence I've suggested is ontological and not formal, there are other... probably come up with other ways of arguing for microphysicalism other than this purely formal way.